Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wait.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
All right. What it is, this is Man King Gary, the media assassin, and we are now tuned in to episode 588, live and direct of Off the Cuff Radio. And this show is sponsored by Cocaine's Buddy Boy Entertainment, Schoolboy Radio, Da Vinci Clothing. Got my host T-Max with the facts on the line tonight.
What it do, man. Another fantastic Friday on at OTC Frequency. We are live, fresh, and direct, ready to go. Shout out to our co-host with Spiro Live Sandman, Lady Chinchilla, and of course, DJ Sincere, Dirty Basement Radio. And we are ready to rock, man. King, let everybody know about who we got with another legendary luminary of hip-hop royalty gracing our platform tonight.
Man, let me tell you, man. Doggy Style came out 13 years ago around this time period. The album that pretty much changed the landscape of hip-hop as you know it, possibly one of the most anticipated hip-hop albums of all time. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to reach out to the players that contributed to this classic. This gentleman in particular that's on the line with us was a part of that. And we want to take our voice and our time to showcase his talents, his contributions, and to let it be known his worth and what he brought to the game. So here to tell his story, his contributions to hip-hop, and where he's going forward, let's all welcome Quick the Glove Taylor to episode 588.
Yeah. Thank you, man. You guys are incredible with that. I appreciate that, and thank you for having me on here.
Man, legend.
Yeah,
Thank you for joining us, man.
Yeah, I did that off the head. I ain't write that down or nothing.
Well, you got skills, baby boy.
Man, look, Chris, this is an honor and privilege. You, dude, you wrote the soundtrack to our youth, man. you gave us, like, you were instrumental in creating so many classic albums and records in terms of what would define that new generation of West Coast fresh, man. This is historic. Yeah, tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm Chris the Glove Taylor, and I'm a DJ. I started in about 1984. I started in 1980. That's where I had to learn what the hell a DJ was that I wanted to be. But then fast forward to my first break was when I was working at a club called Radio, and they put out a movie called Breakin', which was about our club. So I was the DJ in the movie, me, Ice-T, rest in peace, Shabadoo, Boogaloo Shrimp. That was, I'm 21 years old and got a song on the soundtrack, and it sells 4 million copies. So we got multi-platinum record and the movie and you know, the Chaka Khan I Feel For You video they called. They want me to be in the video with her so they can make the crossover tie together. So I got a number one video and move along to working with Dr. Dre and doing some groundbreaking music. After N.W.A. is when I came and got involved with him and started a kind of crusade on not so much sampling and more playing the parts, you know. So I like to think that G-Funk stands for glove, but I don't ever say that to people. So, you know, but going along with that, I got with Dr. Dre around 1989 with Ruthless Records. I was signed there as a producer and an engineer, you know, mixer. And I actually took Dre kind of under my wing. He's a great producer, got hit records. But I showed him some things he wasn't aware of, like the SSL mixing board and those types of – I'm more of a technical guy, and so I showed him some – got him really advanced technologically. It was like he met an alien. And then next thing you know, he taught himself all of those things. I'm just in the room working, doing my part, and watching this guy and watching his greatness.
Absolutely, absolutely. What did you see during that time in terms of what was going on with it, in terms of how things are changing? All right.
I didn't hear the first part of that.
Huh?
Yeah, I didn't hear the first part of that question.
I lost communication for a second. Yeah, and what did you see in terms of this time started changing in terms of how the music was changing, how you were really beginning to be ahead of the game in terms of doing it like that?
Okay, yeah. So what happened is when we were doing 100 Miles and Running, Dre was still heavy into sampling a bunch of sounds. He was into the sound of Chuck D's group, those producers that did that.
Bomb Squad.
And Bomb Squad, he was heavy on that type of sound. And what happened is as they continued to stack that, I was coming in with a different vibe for him. I was more soulful and wanting to do, you know, the first move was when we did a soundtrack for Think Boys in the Hood. We did a song on there where we sampled Bobby Womack. And that was like the turning point to what we were doing musically. And then I was working in a studio where I had all these old keyboards, the Arp Odyssey, a Mini Moog, a Fender Rhodes. I was like, we should just use this old. Now, remember, in the 80s, that stuff was old. Nobody was using it. It was all about, you know, the new, and the synthesizer was coming, and, you know, those things was old. And it was along with the P-Funk sound. So with that being together, it was like, look, we want this sound. We need to use these instruments. The rest of the world, we really weren't listening, you know. Personally, when you make music, you don't have too much time to listen to music, if that makes any sense. So I couldn't tell you if music was, and I was a DJ at the same time, but music to me in the club was different from what you're speaking of, which was changing. Like, we were doing stuff that was hot in the clubs. So, like, those
right.
albums got, like, Dre Day and Let Me Ride, stuff like that was, like, gangster party type music. You know, we did Who Am I with Snoop. You know, that's party music for us. You know.
I mean, but when you look at the entry, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I'm done.
Yeah, but when you look at the entry, Chris, I mean, being in breaking, your introduction to the culture, your contribution was seismic. With breaking 1 and 2, of course, Rest in Peace to Shabadoo. You know, of course, we remember Turbo. Of course, Ice-T was in the second one. I mean, you're talking about the West Coast answer to hip-hop cinema, you know, this show that you all were vital and consequential and historical with your contributions. You know, and this was something about the West Coast. I mean, especially with the radio stations going back to K-Day, Power 106. You know, this is something that really kind of set that template in terms of how people would get to know it later on and what was going on. So, obviously, you were able to really kind of get a feel and a pulse for what was, you know, hot, and then, of course, what was going to come next.
Yeah, I was being a DJ, and I was a house party and club DJ, so I'm a street DJ, you know. So being in the street, you know, we got to go to one part of town to get our gear. You hear music being played out of cars and backyards. Then you got to go to another part of town where the white folks are. That's where my party is, and people got money or whatever. It's different music. And then in between, you know, I used to play soul and new wave all the way across the board, bro. I played it all. And I was just called a Billboard reporter. So when I DJed, all the record labels wanted me to have their record. Where other DJs were looking to join record pools were looking to recruit me because that's how they got their reputation. They have so many Billboard reporters, they get more records. You know what I mean? So I've always had a super pulse. Like, you'll see a DJ with a white label, I'll have a test pressing. You know what I mean? With handwritten label. I'm that DJ. So being that part, being that person, it helped me be ahead and hear music. You know, I broke records like Beatbox from Art of Noise, and I was the first person to ever play that record type thing. Like the Madonna, everybody, and these records. So they make sure I get them for my set that night. And Jelly Bean and Michael Jackson are going to be at the club at radio, so... Jelly Bean Benitez, who was producing Madonna at the time. Or like I'd have Sting or you know, a lot of Clarence Avon, rest in peace. He'll be coming to the club. But this young girl they're going to sign named Janet Jackson, who ain't nobody, she had a flop record, you know. And so this guy's going to sign her and roll with her. And, you know, she's in the club, you know. She's 15, 16, whatever. Radio was 13 and over, no alcohol, but you can bring your own. And they had graffiti artists and break dancers. Yeah, it was, man. It was just a happening, bro. It was so crazy. So all of that life is probably where my rebellious nature comes from within the music that we made, because you could never stop what we were doing. It was, you know, my mom, back in the day, they would tell you, I hear stories about guys saying, don't destroy my record player and all of that from trying to scratch or play records or whatever. Where me, I just researched what was needed, got a student loan, and bought turntables. You know, I didn't have to hear my mom. My mom was saying, come in the house to eat. She wasn't saying, don't scratch up my record player, you know. It was a different thing, man. Yeah, being that my mom and dad supported every move I made.
I mean, but you all had a move in it. Yeah,
I was saying that was dope, man, because, you know, that goes to show you right there that even you being from L.A., they still practice the five elements.
Absolutely. That's the only way it's hip-hop. If it's not, look, if it's not a DJ there, it ain't nothing. It's like a seminar, you know what I'm saying? When the DJ comes, there's music. He got a microphone. Now this guy want to talk on it. You think he gonna tell everybody move their car? He start rapping. Now you got Ice-T, who's been on TV for 40 years because he took the microphone. Watch yourself. And so, you know, that's how it goes. But DJ had the equipment. The DJ is hip hop. Everything else is a part of it. Graffiti artists are also individuals to hip hop because they don't need a party to go spray a train. They do it in secret. So those elements. See, the thing is, all the elements should be able to run independently of each other. But rappers need DJs and musical equipment. They can't be independent. A DJ can be independent. Back in the day, the DJs were the rappers. They would call a DJ so-and-so. Like, I think it was DJ Afrika Bambaataa. You know?
Right.
Grandmaster Flash. he was the group, and the Furious Five. Like, that should say a whole lot. And a lot of the rappers didn't like that, so it changed.
Yeah.
Eric being Rakim became Rakim.
Yeah.
The God MC, you know. And,
yeah.
You
know, but yeah, but it was about being that, I mean, but when you look at it, I mean, of course, you know, yourself, rest in peace, you know, Mixmaster Spade, rest in peace, so many. You know, Ronnie-O, I mean, yeah, Ronnie-O and Joe Cooley, I mean, the
yeah.
West was really beginning, you know, I mean, who can forget about the parties, you know, that used to go down at Palladium, Skate Land, all those spots.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know,
Yeah,
shout out to, you know, Uncle Doug, you know, Doug Young, who's been on the show a couple
yeah,
of times.
I know
gave
us my
history. Yeah, man. You know, Kenya Ware, we love her so much, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll talk off air about all that, but yeah, man,
there's been a lot of people that's been involved with helping us in our journey as well, man.
Oh yeah, I love that, man. I know these names, man. These are my people. Yep, the LA journey with music is quite an interesting one, man, because it's different factions. You got, I'm from the West Side in South Central. Then you got the Latinos that are in El Monte. They feel like they created scratching and it started there. And then you have brothers that's from Compton saying that they're the godfather of hip-hop. So I can tell you this. I was scratching records before them dudes was out of high school, most of them. So I don't know. Godfather probably really more like a big brother to me, you know what I mean? Like, that day godfather, that's my brother. He a year or two older than me. Like, I'm 61, man. I've been doing this for a while. I laugh because I hear people talk about, oh, I was here, I was there. Then I do the math. I say, how old are you? Oh, I'm there. I say, you would have been 11 years old. There's no way you were at radio.
Right.
You were not there. If you're 50 years old, you're not old enough to have been there.
They got to exaggerate the age.
Yeah.
They forget, man. They saw the movie and think they was in breaking. You know, it's that memory Mandela effect thing. You add yourself to stuff. We live in a universe in our brain. If you close your eyes, you ain't going to see nothing. And when you open them, you're going to see everything you want to look at. You're going to point your face to what you want to see. So it's your universe, you know. Your universe is going to have in what you believe. If you believe that that's what happened, that's what's happened. I make the difference sometimes of all.
Yeah. When you saw, as the West Coast began to really come to prominence in terms of, you know, pretty much 1986 is considered one of the watershed years for the West Coast. Of course, you know, NWA and the Posse dropped their album, and also Ice-T drops Rampage, you know, which are two seminal releases, which were really kind of get everybody on notice about what was going on out there. Tell us about some of the rappers that you met along the way in terms of who was, you know, making noise at the local level before they would hit the national stage during your time coming up.
Oh, yeah. When I was coming up, I was working with guys like CJ Mack was a rapper coming up. I did his very first record. He couldn't come to my house because he was a gangbanger, so my mom made him stay in the yard. So I had to set the microphone up in the patio and run the cable through the window. He rapped out there. We did some demos and then went on to record some of his songs on his album. I worked with, I came with Arabian Prince, Egyptian Lover, other vocalists like NG, and he used to be the Spin Masters. Then you had Nipsey Hussle all the way fast forward. You know, of course, Snoop. And I knew these guys, Warren and them, when they were, you know, in high school, basically, or just coming out. These are the guys on the street and in the undercurrent. You know, Mossberg, rest in peace. You know, all of these guys. I basically came across pretty much everybody that rapped. Tone Low, Young MC, people don't talk about them. You know, and then my boys were like, Bobcat is one of the DJs that came off of my family tree. And he went on with LL, and, you know, so I was around these guys. There's a lot, man. A lot.
Yeah, especially when we covering hip hop is 50, man, there's so many names, man. Like, there's so many names. We didn't even scratch the surface of so many names, or even the fallen soldiers that put this thing together.
Oh, yeah. There's so many names. Like, I don't even, I couldn't, I probably said, I'm such a minuscule amount of names. There's hundreds. There's Domino. There's, I could just, I got to go by neighborhoods because I can't come. So you go to Long Beach, I got 6 rappers. You go to Compton, I got 19 rappers, you know. You got MCH, you got Compton Most Wanted, you got Above the Law, you got Dr. Dre, you got Eazy, Jinx. All these guys grew on the same street. Like, that's just there. Then you come to my neighborhood, I'm Crenshaw and Slauson. So all that comes from me. So I'm claiming Corrupt and the Dog Pound and, you know, everything that's them. When you hear that, that's me. I was the person from that area. They were coming to my house. And then they had family, too, that were, oh, you live down the street from my cousin. I'm going to go over here. And they gangsters. You know what I mean? So they get to get the whole, and I'm not no banger, but I live right, I'm in the mix. I'm the first music guy from over there that did hip-hop. I mean, Ronnie Laws has lived down the street from me. So there was always somebody with hot music. Like I said, Tucson McCall taught me how to play the organ. He already had a gold record playing the organ. So, you know, it's so many West Coast artists. And I'm just talking about rappers and MCs in the L.A. area, not even to singers. You got, what, Tyrese and what's the This Is How We Do It, Dude, and all that. I mean, we got
Montel Jordan
kind of
and
yeah, there you Battle go. Cat. Yeah, Battle Cat. That's my boy. He's one of the baddest producers around. Battle Cat got a lot of records, man. That's my guy right there. Shout out to Battle Cat. What's up, Cat?
These guys, man, great Cat Quick. They give you the L.A. state of mind. Like, they make you be like, man, we got to go out and visit L.A., man. That just tells us out of town is what it is. Because they bring that flavor to the record.
Thank you. Yes, man, we enjoy making music and keeping the streets safe.
Absolutely.
That's why I stay home.
So now you're making this transition into music, man. What are, like, your top 5 produced albums, like favorite produced albums?
Anyone or my own?
It could be any of it. Could be anything. Like, it could be any from any genre. Like, whatever inspired you.
I think the top 5 projects that influenced me. I did this guy did an interview with me, and he asked me to tell him the songs that I listened to before I became a producer. And that's pretty much what would be in this top 5. Like, it wouldn't be no hip-hop, unless you're talking about somebody I want to produce or work with.
Or it could be music, like, in general. It could be any album.
Yeah. So I'm thinking my top 5, starting with 5, it's like Off the Wall is number 5. Mm. That's like, that guy was a kid doing. So Michael Jackson, I recently heard that Drake or somebody just equaled or surpassed Michael Jackson in number 1. I said, yeah, that's an asterisk, homie. Michael Jackson was also the Jackson 5 and the Jacksons. They got like 20 more ones up in there, my brother. You, those are number 1. Oh, that ain't even chart. So, yeah, that's not unfair. That's an unfair count. Michael Jackson was the Jacksons. If you listen to the background vocals, it's him. His low voices are the other brothers. So when they went and turned that into Off the Wall Michael Jackson, that was production in its finest. I've never seen a man make another man sound so. He opened up like he didn't turn to a flower. He turned to a USC Rose Garden. You know what I mean? This dude.
Right.
Wow. So, right. So Off the Wall, right? Number 5. Number 4, the number four album for me would be Earth, Wind & Fire, All in All. That's number four. That's the one with Reasons in September, right? Or September's in six. It's a big gold disc. Whichever one got Reasons on it is the one. I know, right? Number three is Dream of the Blue Turtles by Sting. Y'all remember that Sting album he put out where Nas and them sampled and became Affirmative Action and all, a whole bunch of stuff came off of that.
Yeah.
That's number three. My number two is Peter Gabriel's Soul. That dude decided to make an album, which is what I'm doing. And he just made it. And he spent as much money as he wanted on it, and that was a fucking brilliant album, Peter Gabriel. And then number one is The Chronic.
Yeah, man, that makes all of our listeners want to dig in the crates. I had to shoot that one to you, man, because we want to know where what pioneered those sounds that you helped create for another generation, and that goes into another generation, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. You know, I feel like the reason that, so we hear us, I hear my brothers my age and a little younger, my generation of hip-hop, complaining mostly about the music that's today. And to me, it's like hearing people talk about the kids are bad, and then they pick they badass kids up from school. Like everybody kids are bad, bro. Yours too. Mine too, right? It ain't they kids. It's all kids. So instead of complaining about the music, I decided to try to, you know, I feel like it's our fault. They think that they just want to point and say, man, your music is bad. Bruh, we listen to Earth, Wind & Fire and Lakeside. They grew up on Coolio. How the hell are they supposed to make good music when they're hearing Coolio, slide, slide, slippity slide? They're not hearing Lakeside the real way it went down. They grew up on they grew up on fast food music. Their music gonna sound like fast music. You feel me?
Right. Right.
So we got to take them back to the basics, all the way back. They need. That's why I love seeing these things where the dudes be like, "Oh, I got so and so that can hear the song." They'll play like a Nelly song. Excuse me. Oh yeah. So they hear a Nelly song, and then they'll play the original sample, or the kid will know they're like a young girl dating an older guy or whatever. Some of them, you know, they play, and so you get to hear Anita Baker, and you know, really, I don't want to sound like it's really about the study. Like, if I hadn't studied Beethoven and Mozart, I wouldn't understand some things. But if I just skipped over that and went to, you know, I even went into Vivaldi and Brahms and all these other guys, you know. But if you don't know nothing about it, then you'll never know about it. You don't know what you don't know.
Man, you said Beethoven. You said Beethoven. And that's like a special place in my heart, especially Moonlight Sonata, second movement, A flat major. First heard that a boy named Charlie Brown when Schroeder was playing that, and I was hooked on Beethoven since then.
What instrument?
Classic. In terms of, go ahead.
What instrument did you hear it on when you fell in love with it? What was it being played on?
Piano. Piano. It was a boy named Charlie Brown when Schroeder has that piano solo. And I was a Beethoven fan ever since. I mean, when you look at Beethoven's Fifth, you know, everything from his requiems to his ballads. I mean, everything is just...
Right.
Well, Mozart is considered to be more technically proficient. To me, Beethoven had more panache.
But Beethoven had
passion.
Layers.
Yes, absolutely. Ludwig was special. You know, you got Tchaikovsky, Brahms, like you said, and all of them. But yeah, Beethoven, to me, is the best.
I like Vivaldi the best. He had more... Stop. He had more, I would say, I liked his chamber music. He played all of his movements on the harpsichord. He stays more in the area. I like his movements, and I like his, you know, he's B minor, A flat major, you know what I mean? Shit like that. Oh, I mean stuff like that. But yeah, that is where my head is at, because I make my music, wicked music. You know, my music is in the... I do dark music sometimes, but I know how to flip the coin, so I like Vivaldi. he's more, you know, broke. You know what I mean?
Now, you know what? Speaking of dark music, I got to skip this to here, man. Like, how involved were you on the Niggas for Life album? Because one of the craziest beats I ever heard was Approach the Danger.
Yeah, right. No, I didn't do anything on there, bro. I'm telling you, I came in right at 100 miles and running,
okay.
And then the first thing that I worked on with Dre was that thing we did for outside of my group, and Michelet was, it was that Bobby Womack thing for what you call it. And then we did something else we did. But it was all ruthless was us leaving. So we didn't make that much music when we got ready to start working on. We did the Chronic album so we could go get a deal and get out of there. And
now,
then after that, Doggy Style, mm-hmm. while we was on tour, that shit was a motherfucking Doggy Style.
when you look at it, Glove from... Oh, go, yeah, when you look at a Glove from...
No, go ahead.
Building, yeah, but when you look at everything, Glove, from how N.W.A. had been starting to blow up, you know, obviously the Posse album came out in 86 and then Straight Outta Compton would drop in 88, which really opened up the door. But also, too, I mean, this is also a time where you start seeing, you know, the collective of a lot of those guys. Of course, we can't forget, you know, Big Hutch, a.k.a. Cole 187 from Above the Law, you know, a good friend of ours. You know, so we're seeing this whole, what would be the layers of G-Funk starting, of course, the nascent nature, but yet and still will grow into something monumental. Of course, Dre, yourself, you know, you all really, really, like, are instrumental in that. To see how N.W.A. impacted the West Coast and to see that growth, what was it like? What did you feel in terms of where you all were headed in terms of the musical direction? And did you all know at the time that you all would transform hip-hop in a way that nobody anticipated?
Absolutely. The way... What we were doing is that we just wanted to, you know, we was just like kind of making shit we like, bro. We really didn't care about nothing else, bro. We didn't listen to many people. I had my R&B group, and then I was working on that. I really didn't want to do rap, but I was working with Dre, so I was like, what we doing? I'm rapping. Okay, let's go. And we kind of took music in a direction that we felt we wanted to go. It's like I always tell people, man, they say that you're a leader, but a true leader generally goes somewhere and he turns around and looks behind him and it's a gang of people following him. He didn't even know they was back there. And that's kind of how we do it. We just kind of was, we weren't trying to change sound. We were trying to be dope. And we wanted a dope name. What was dope? The Chronic was a dope way to say dope without saying cocaine. So we did that. None of us even smoke weed. Soup smoke weed.
It was all metaphor.
But when you think about it, because we were young in 1992 when the Chronic dropped in the fall. You know, I believe it was October, November of 1992 when the Chronic album would drop. All we knew, because this is, you know, we tell our listeners, this is pre-social media. You know, magazines, and we were still, I didn't start reading The Source until 1994. So all I knew about was just watching the music videos and then watching MTV News and watching BET, and then you see, you know, they say legendary, you know, N.W.A. group member Dr. Dre is getting ready to drop a solo record, and we're like, holy shit, like, and then we heard G-Thing, and we were like, oh my God. But even then, before then, we had heard Dr. Dre deep cover during the summer for the movie, and we saw this, like, tall motherfucker from Long Beach rapping his ass off, his name's Snoop Dogg, and we're like, yo.
Whoa. That just all happened. Kept
that's exactly
over.
How we were feeling.
Yeah, me too.
It was mind-blowing.
Only we were in the studio doing that.
Tell us about how that whole thing came together with the initial bomb with Deep Cover and how, because this is about a year after Dre leaves Ruthless, given the situation that had been going on. How did you all huddle together, like, you know, the West Coast offense and, you know, figure out a play to run in terms of what was coming next? Take us through that history. We got plenty of time. Let's get it.
All right. So what happened was we left Ruthless and we started working on this Chronic album. And actually, we was working on the album kind of before we met Snoop, you know. And then we met Snoop and shit got wild. It got, you know, started really flying up. And, but we didn't have a record deal. And, you know, we had some money from a publishing deal, $1 million. So that went ghost. Money go fast when you got a gang of people in a studio and it's gone. So we didn't even really have a name yet, but we had this music. So this guy, Jimmy Iovine, was going to meet with Dre and Suge, but he paid, Jimmy Iovine paid a fee to meet with Dre. It was dope. We was like, what? He's like, look, Dre was going to go somewhere else. Jimmy said, I'll give you this to come here. And he said, we finna go see Jimmy today. He finna give me this. Okay. So once we started making the record, I mean, we were still making the record. It was done when we met Jimmy. It was, I was already done. But, you know, we were mixing and whatnot. And it was just a trip because, like, we're making the record. We're mixing. I'm signing contract to Death Row Records in the midst of it. There was no name. You know, it was just Future Shock or some shit. I can't even remember.
Right,
but,
that's Future Shock.
So then we, it became that, and I'm signing this contract, and we worked it, and we making records, and then we going on tour, and then we, you know, bro, it was so fast. Then we did Above the Rim. Like, we had Snoop Doggy Style. Then we did Above the Rim. We did all that shit in 1 year, bro. It was like, I was busy, man. That shit was crazy.
Man,
look. That's the answer. It was crazy.
Well, look, Chris, before we get into the rest of that illustrious history, what was the science back in the day of how artists went about, because you said Jimmy Iovine basically opened up the wallet for it. How did artists back in the day go about in terms of obtaining record deals, in terms of those negotiations and those meetings, in terms of how you got on?
They meet with us. Where our music was hot. You can make a left here. Oh, can you turn that behind? Our music was hot, and that was it. It was just, we was dope. And we didn't do no negotiating. It was like, y'all niggas are dope. What do you want? You know, it was none of that, man. My experience in the music industry is completely different than most. I always got whatever I wanted. I could use any equipment. It was like unlimited budget, the whole bag.
You said unlimited budget. Okay.
That's like a stand kid at a candy store.
With an asterisk, whatever Hyde Park is. But I'll tell you, being in that area where, so we do deep cover, right? So me, Trey Cullen, will go to the studio. We're like, okay, he got the beat he want to do and blah, blah, but he wants the bass. So we got the stand-up bass, right? Standard.
Mm-hmm.
So Colin's playing this bass line, and Dre's like, no, I want it to be like this. I'm like, you need a fretless bass for that. A junior.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went around the corner, no, next door, and bought a Clevenger Junior bass from Colin Plant just to play doo-doo-doo-doo, because we were playing a sample. So it wasn't sounding the same when he was using another bass. We figured out what bass it was. I figured it out. And so that's the kind of shit. The bass is like $2,000. We go buy this bass and lay this part. I think we left the bass or Colin took it. Dre didn't give a shit about that bass. He didn't want it. He wanted the sound. That was it.
That's the budget. That's what I'm used to working on it. So I still work like that. It never stops. That's why it takes us so long and it costs so much. If you want to make music that sounds like ours, you got to spend money.
You just can't do it in the bedroom. I've never made one of... None of those. The only one I made at my house was stranded on death row. That's it. Everything else was in a $1 million studio.
Man, to get these stories, Chris, is historic because, you know, to hear from people that were there and to also you know, of course, give flowers to those, you know, along the way that we lost, like DJ Train, Easy, you know, so many others that were instrumental. Yeah, man, rest in peace to Mr. Lars, man. I mean, he, oh, God, I mean, that, I mean, to go back in, and he didn't know his family was out, but that man went back into a house fire to save his family because he thought they were still in there. And,
I mean, wow.
Yeah, man. But, I mean, rest in peace to Train, man. But when you look at everything in terms of how that history, you all part something. When you first heard Deep Cover, when you first heard that bass, in terms of the tracking, you know, because it starts off with a bass, like you said, doom.
Let me help you.
Go ahead, go ahead.
The way you hear that song, the way it was introduced to the world, is not the way we know that song.
Okay, first, tell
so like
that.
When I told you we needed that bass, we already had the beat and everything, so it was a sample, had the beat and everything down, but the bass wasn't sounding right. So I was like, let's go get the bass. Like, so then we broke it down and made that intro. Well, when I first heard the beat, it was when we was putting it together. So I'll give you another story. Let's move to, I did a track for a song called Phone Tap. So that's with Nas and AZ and them, right, the firm. So when I did this Phone Tap, that's what Big Boy plays every day. He plays the phone taps on that track I did. Mm-hmm. So when I made that track, mm-hmm. I had an idea and a concept and a sample. So I worked that out. I got the headphones. I'm in the drum machine. I made all of that by myself, and I'm playing it in my headphones. And then I just shortened the story for you because it's some creative story part of that within the drums.
We got time.
And all, but
we got time. Tell as much as you want. We got time.
Well, you said long form. So when I sit down to compose Phone Tap, there's some drums inside the drum machine. So I turn on my boy Butter. I'm like, these are your drums, bro. Let's take them out. I want to put some drums in, find some drums. I got this thing going. And he's like, oh, no, you can use that. And I looked at him like, bro, don't be nonchalant with these drums. And he's like, no, you can use whatever you want, bro. I said, let me tell you something. If I use these drums, you'll never be able to use them again, bro. You can't. That's it. So he said, ha, ha, ha. Like, you know, yeah, right, Mr. Big Stuff. You know what I'm saying? So, I told him, right, I said like, yeah. I told him, listen, if I use these drums, you won't be able to use them. He said, okay, use them. So, you know, the drums for Phone Tap are, like, specific for that. No one else has ever used them except in a song called Can't Believe, where they sample Phone Tap.
Yeah,
so,
faith. Yeah.
So that's just that part of the story. But anyway, so I'm whipping the beat up, and I got it going. I'm listening to it. Because I had to flip the loop in a way to make it extend. It wasn't long enough, and it was weird. I had to do calculus in my head and figure some new shit out. I was on some new shit. So
okay,
anyway,
calculus.
I worked it out. Yeah, it was way out. It wasn't in the right time signatures, a whole bunch of shit to it. So I got it in there, and then I knew I wanted to replay it with different instruments. The guitar, I wanted the guitar to play the clarinet part I had. So, I'm sorry. What I went on
okay.
to do was, I got this beat now in my headphones, right? I'm banging in the headphones like, okay, this is cranking. So Dre and them, they had a thing where the drum machine I'm using is connected and ready to be recorded onto the multi-track. It's all in the board and hooked up. So he reaches over his, he goes, what's love cooking on? He hits the button, turns it all the way up, and they hear Phone Tap, the beat. So that's normally to make fun of you, right? Like you halfway through a beat. Most guys be going, no, wait. So I looked at him, he turned it up, and then the door flew open. Nas, AZ, the track masters all came running in. They was downstairs working on, I think what happened was they was working on Desperado. And I heard that Desperado beat, and I was like, oh, shit, they got the hottest shit going right there. That Desperado is fire. I got to top that. And so I did Phone Tap. And they came upstairs to hear what the noise. They left what they were doing to come and see what Dre did. That's how that worked. What? And so I saw notepads come out. The papers tore up. They wrote that song in like 5 minutes. So, you know. I mean, I came with the concept for the phone voice because I always wanted to have a song. I needed somebody whose voice was noticeable that you would know that sounded like a phone so that they didn't have to sound. When we mix records, make their voice sound perfect. I wanted to do the opposite, make the voice sound like shit. And so we did it. So that's the kind of, like, I like to bring to the table. When I'm, that was me making a beat and hearing for the first time and being like, damn. But, I mean, you know, seeing the reaction of others. All that other stuff. Now, when we did Snoop's album, it was a party. G-Thing was a party, too. It was a gang of people there the whole time. Normally, when you want something for people to party to, you need a party. You can't. So when we make music, it's truly a laboratory. Like, you can't be stupid or goofy about it. If you're making dance music, people need to be dancing when you make the music. You know what I'm saying? It's that simple. You want love music, you need some romance around. Have some girls and guys. And what you doing in the room goes on the tape. That's why my buddy used to tell me, man, I want to do a weed song. But he didn't smoke weed. He play this and play that. What's this, make a record? What's this? Does it sound like it? Does it sound like that? No. What is it? So one day he did an edible, right? And he did a track and he sent it to me. He played it for me over the phone. I said, hey, nigga, what's that? That sound like, and I didn't say a weed song, but and he said, yeah. I said, what you? He said, I'm on some edibles. I said, the only way you can make a weed song is to be high, or weed's got to be in the room, bro. If you're trying to achieve that. What we did was we made an album and then called it The Chronic. It ain't nothing on that album about weed except for the roach. So this going to take you to the beach, and that's my house, and that's the siren. Yeah. You're not fucking with your mood. That's the one car that stopped for you. And that other truck that tried to run you over. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm with my homeboy. It's another magnificent artist. I'm not even going to tell you his name yet. This thing is sick. So anyway, we're coming off of the studio right now. This is the whole, you want to ask me about this story in 20 years. The same thing. This is loop again. So, I mean, down to, if you knew this guy's story, when did the story come out? This dude's a boxer. Like a bare-knuckle boxer almost. Like, you know what I'm saying? Damn near street fighter by night to make money to pay his bills.
Man.
So, yeah, bro, this is it. This is real. Straight. You think at the beach, you're going to turn right. It's going to be too light.
Before the Firm album, obviously before you do Phone Tap, when the Chronic album dropped, it was such a shift. It was nothing we had ever heard before. You all had arrived at a nuclear level once that hit. Take us through that 1992 to 95 journey in terms of what was happening, because that's what we had to get back to earlier about, you know, Chronic, Doggy Style, Above the Rim, you know, everything that was happening during that time, and when you all realized, like, this ain't no regular shit no more, like, y'all are, like, superstar on.
Mm-hmm. Shit, man, when we started working on that, everything happened fast, bro. We was just, this is what I tell my young people, man, like, I tell my man now, it's now, it's not time, you're not going to be in the big time, it is the big time, so know you in the big. When we was working on Snoop's album, every day. Actually, when we was working on The Chronic, Snoop would ask us, yo, people going to know who I am, Dr. Dre? And we was like, you're going to be as famous as Michael Jackson, bro. We're going to sell, your album going to sell like Michael Jackson, bro. We're going to break records. We'd say this every day to Snoop. He would reaffirm every day or every couple of hours, two, three times a day, multiple times, keep on past the next two legs. And then, you know, we came out the first, we sold more records still to this day in the first day than any other solo new artist. 800,000 in a week, 390 in a day. 390,000 albums in one day, bro. People had to leave work and go buy them. There wasn't no downloads. There would have been a million if there was downloads.
Oh, God.
People got off work, lined up, and bought this album. They don't do that for music no more. They don't even do it for tickets. They go straight for it. So, you know, we wrecked shop, bro. When we came in, it was nobody's business. We was tearing it up. You're going to make it right into this shop. So, So, I'm going to tell you, man, it, at the time, things were moving so fast. Shit was going so hard. It was just fucking amazing, bro. I couldn't even begin. I couldn't even tell you when was Thursday. You know what I'm saying? And that's really kind of it. It was so much going on, bro. Right over here, and I'm going to hop up. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Maybe you could ask me a more specific, like, when I was with Dre or when I worked with Tupac, because it was so much stuff. It was
more.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you this. Yeah, I was going to ask you this myself, man. Like, you know, you being under Dre's jurisdiction, you tend to give detail of Dre's role as a producer, because people tend to get that term wrong about what he really does in the studio. Like, you care to give clarification about what his role as a producer is?
I can do that for sure. Dr. Dre is two things. Number one, hang on, I'm about right here. Baby boy, I appreciate you. We're going to chop it up. Yes. This. If I leave anything, if I do, get it back to me. Should be good, right? Yep.
All right.
My boy. I have to get out the... Okay, so Dr. Dre is a producer. Let me tell you something, man. I don't play well with others at all because I know how to do everything in the studio. I mean, like, I know how to turn on the power in the studio, okay? I know, like, I'm going to do this show called Producer Island where two producers go and come out with product. You see what I mean? Like, no engineer, no musicians, no nothing. Just the producers, Producer Island. We're going to see who's dope. But Dr. Dre, this dude is not only a project leader, but he's a genius and a musical genius. He's not only a genius, but he's a coach. So, like, he would tell me, like, the way I did Stranded on Death Row, this dude's producing songs, and he got a deadline. So he know he got these other songs. So he got me. I need you to do this. Okay, cool. I'm going to go to my house. Like I said, that's the one thing I did at the house. So I go to the house. He said, I want you to take this beat, loop it with this bass line, and put this with it. I said, okay. I went home. I made the beat that became Stranded on Death Row based upon his specifications. Yeah. He told me do this, this, and this. And then I did it. But I did it. You know what I'm saying? I put the track together. I put the music on there. I recorded it down on the set. I mixed it. You know what I mean? We did it, but there's some of me in we. You know, it ain't just another person. So, I don't attribute that to Dre at all because I don't feel like that's his place. There's people who do credits, and there's people who's supposed to make sure that you get whatever. A production is paperwork as well as music.
Right.
And
right.
The most important part is that. And when he delivers that as well. With all the music he's done, there's only a few people who, you know, look, bro, go to any place that's hired a great number of people and see how many people have felt slighted in a way. You see what I mean?
Right.
Whether it was the boss's attitude or they didn't pay him on time and they feel like they stole it when it could have been a mistake. You know, so, hey, I lean to the fact that people are human and they're really not trying to screw you, basically. So if that's the life I live in my head. So if there's some misprints or mistakes on my end, that's just something that's got to get cleared up. But as far as greatness, and I would not work with anyone else. I work with Dr. Dre, though.
And sometimes that's important in terms of knowing the chemistry and the camaraderie. You know, it's all about how you combine to make something classic because you both understand the vision of it. And sometimes we've seen in rap groups, we've seen it with sports teams. You know,
mm-hmm. We
see it in regular life. You have people who sometimes let their ego become the excess because they think they are the everything when they are the something but not the singular thing. And when you're trying to bring it together as a cohesive, collaboration, everybody contributes to a team win. And I think sometimes with some people, they don't understand that. For where you all were, because this is before, you know, this is before Pop, you know, gets with y'all on Death Row. Tell us about how marketing was for albums, how it was done back then, what it was like to actually do interviews with magazines, and then how you all put together, like, video projects, the treatments for it, how you all wanted to do a full rollout for what was there.
Well, that's funny because, so now, I was involved with a lot of segments of the rollout because I was doing a lot of work in other areas like creating videos and creating concepts for when we were touring, came up with the stage concept again. So I'm involved in a lot of different areas, and I will be with Dre on some autograph signings, especially when we're on the road. But basically, with all of the roll-ups and all of that and everything, where I would be at present at events. I wasn't there scheduling and setting up. You know, I'm 29. We made the music. They sold the music. You know what I'm saying? So basically, the thing that I liked the most was how the streets reacted to us once we became Death Row. But one thing I do know is on the street team level, we had everybody in L.A. basically wearing Death Row shirts for a record drop. You know, so we had a lot of community awareness because of Suge and the movements he was making in the different neighborhoods. So that was a really big part of it. Plus, at this time in our lives in L.A., there's no major musical movement. It's N.W.A., and that died off, remember? And Easy is the enemy, and their music is whack anyway, so they don't sell like us. Like in that one year, we had the Chronic, Doggy Style, and Above the Rim. We sold over $105 million in revenue. Three albums, $105 million. You heard me? A lot of money. So the way those things were set up and delivered, I tell you this, any record that is going to come out in the Superstars album, they have a, like, to be unlimited budget. There's probably a number between 10 and 13 million that they put towards the record. If you can't spend $13 million on the record, you're weak. And that's how it goes. You trip, huh? It's a lot of money. Not a little bit.
Man. Now, we're talking about all this. Now, this is where it gets, you know, a little bit dicier and spicier, because this is where we start seeing the gang element come in more and more prominently. Back in the day in the early 90s, you had an idea with a lot of these artists, what they were doing from a perspective of they were in the street, you know, Shout of Compton's Most Wanted, DJ Quick and all of them. But yet it still was about how they were doing.
I didn't hear the last part.
Yeah, but it was like we started seeing this come to prominence. What was it like when, you know, at the West Coast, when you really started seeing more of the gang element come into it in terms of people being more open about their sets? Of course, Suge, you know, being Mob Haru, and it was really becoming a thing out there in terms of, you know, rappers being more open about their affiliations and even membership in the gang.
You're joking, right, bro? Snoop, first thing he came out there, he was cripping on the records like, bro, they've been doing that. There was always happening. They just got more
right.
and more popular
right.
as far as
right.
the record
oh,
sales.
Gosh.
This dude
right.
was
right.
doing their thing. It didn't just happen. Hip-hop and banging always been together.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't no separation. Most of it, I mean, go look at Banging on Wax, and you're going to see Battle Cat on the cover with a mask on. Like, trust me, bro, it's all the same. It's always been that way. And drug dealers. Because where else are we going to get the money from? Don't white people don't believe in us. So we going to get this from the niggas in the hood that had it.
Yeah,
street
culture.
You know, is that guy.
Goes hand
I'm
hand
sorry?
Street culture. I said it goes hand
yeah,
in hand
bro.
With street culture.
Any movement. You got to be moving on the ground level. Or you won't have any movement upstairs. So that's that. But, you know, gang, it got more... It got louder. People started
right.
using it as a way to sell records. Like, N.W.A. was not a gang group. They talked about violence in the hood and stuff and did shit like a bunch of wild nerds, to be honest with you. You didn't hear them
right.
saying nothing about a tech or running up on. They was robbers and thieves. They was a band of, they were outlaws, you know? That was the whole concept, outlaws. Fuck the police, you know? Then it went to the police. Chronic and became Bitches Ain't Shit.
Right.
So that was the whole doggy style, Bitches Ain't Shit. That's why I'm getting them doggy style. That's why this I'm called yep. missionary, because now he respects the women a little more.
Yep. When you look at it from the hood section, Chris, how important was it for your hood to get behind you in terms of you being an artist, you know, breaking out, especially on the West Coast?
Man, look, in L.A., it's like when people find out that you do something and you live in that neighborhood, it's cool, bro. It ain't no hood, nothing, bro. I wasn't no banger. I didn't have to pretend like I was, like I didn't go to Juilliard and was on the set, you know, and had to act like I couldn't dance and some shit. I grew up in Ladera Heights, man. All the houses was $1 million when I was a kid. Like, I ain't never been, bro, the 60s come up here to rob people. And maybe one or two live up here. But like, I don't even, I went to Inglewood and all that, but I don't get that whole, I wasn't that. My life is different. I was, I'm more like the kid who had, you know, figured out how to get the equipment to be the DJ, you know, as opposed to, man, I had to go and sleep on my man's couch to practice to be DJ and take 4 trains in the borough, and I was 11 and I didn't have no food to eat. Nah. I got a student loan and got some turn. I said, hey, Dad, I'm supposed to buy books with this, but I'm in the broadcasting stuff at school, so can I get some turntables? He said, hell yeah, let's go. He said, you can get whatever you want with that student loan, because you have to pay it back. I said, okay. I ain't never paid it back. It's like $800,000 now, bro. Seriously. Don't mess with them student loans. If I could go back and tell myself that, I'd be like, go get a student loan. Go get that money. Go. You better break in that store and steal them turntables. I would tell myself to steal the turntables before I tell myself to get a student loan, okay? Hey, that's for broken loans. Oh, no, it's not. That's some shit I knocked off.
Hey, who knows, man? You probably come up with a song off the concept alone, man. That's the beauty of dialogue, man. You can just be creative within the dialogue.
That's what we do, man. Come on. Dude, but I tell you what, though. So I will tell you this. The one thing I noticed during the whole transition from NWA to when I was on the road with Dre and he was NWA, it was a whole lot of white kids that asked for autographs, bro. It wasn't like, they were everywhere. I mean, if we went to Calabasas to the mall, there's some of the white kids wanting some information. Finding that.
Hey, you know what I think? I think what happened with that was when they put them on that Rolling Stone cover, that crossed them over to, like, rock star status. You know what I mean?
Bro, NWA was rockstar status off the first album, because we changed the whole way, thank you. The whole way that music was calculated to be number one, they started doing it based upon sales, because NWA sold so many records the first week. Everybody tried to copy their method and front load, but it didn't work. NWA would sell 100,000 week one and sell 2 million in the month. It would stay number one until the record wouldn't sell no more. Like, so we changed a lot of things. The way they calculated the record sales, we changed that. They talked about, that's why they call our music West Coast music, because it's too unbelievable that 90% of it comes from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like, and it's in a small area within 10 miles. Long Beach ain't but 10 miles from me. And this is where the nucleus of the music industry is. Well, we got so much music, they put it to the whole coast. Like, I can name the people that's not in L.A. E-40, Too Short.
The Bay. Yeah,
Keep the
Sneak.
San Diego got a couple people, and then they got Sir Mix-a-Lot. Sir Mix-a-Lot is Seattle. I ain't heard of nobody from Oregon, but it might be. But that's it. It's L.A. They just don't want to say L.A. music. They call it West Coast. Hell, L.A. not even on the coast. Inglewood and Santa Monica is, motherfucker. Excuse me. Ain't no coastal L.A. You got to go to another city to get to the beach. Venice. You know what I mean? Manhattan Beach. All the beaches got different names, man. They're all different cities. Not L.A. Where's L.A. Beach? See? Y'all from L.A.
Nah, I'm from... Nah, we from the... We from
somebody...
We from the South.
All y'all from the South South. Somebody in here was from L.A.
Yeah.
Somebody said...
Nah, we're both from the South.
Oh, I misheard that. I was thinking I heard that. I heard something else. We're from the same time frame, but not the same city.
No, it's all
good.
But we grew up.
Yeah,
but we grew up and definitely heavy on the West Coast vibe in terms of how y'all, you know, did it. I mean, I have a big love for the West Coast ever since I was young in terms of, growing up. I mean, listening to guys like Compton Price, you know, Sinister, you know, I mean, E-40 I got on a little bit later, but I was once I was on E-40 board, I was amazed. Of course, later on, like you mentioned, San Diego, guys like Nikki Slick, J.O. Felon, you know.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, we were basically, the ones that, you know, with being musical stores, we was like, man, look, the West is going to be the next to pretty much change the landscape. Because, you know, out here, they had that coastal bias at the time. West Coast, so
right.
They can't. We as soon as Snoop and Dre came through and hit, everybody brought the fan wagon.
Man, for real, right? That's the way it goes.
But all it took was like a, because you go Deep Cover. Deep Cover was basically, it sounded like a new, like an E Hardy Coast record. So it gave it something to somewhere vibe to.
Yeah, Deep Cover was it. Mm-hmm. Deep 40 was it.
Oh.
Deep Cover, yeah, that was a bad song, wasn't it?
I like that, the remix of that, because that had a harder Snoop verse in it.
Mm-hmm. Which verse did he do on that one, the one you like?
It was like on the Max. It was like a different verse he had up there. I think T-Max had the Max single to that.
What's that?
I ain't heard that.
I'm gonna find it and I'm gonna tag you in it, man, because it was like another version of that of the song.
Mm-hmm.
That's fire though.
Yeah, I'm gonna let you. Yeah, after the show, I'm gonna send it to you.
Okay.
All right.
When you think about where the West Coast, where it was going, and then everybody else that was coming along at that time, because you had so many other guys who were really like King C, you know, you had Cam, you know, of course, Dove Shack. It was the West, it just been, I mean, it was just opening up so much more. As it progressed, and you all were really seeing it just be way different because of how you all were looking. As, and I'm kind of losing my train of thought, but I was trying to get it back. You all were already kind of moving. Tell us about the situation with Tupac before he officially was announced on Death Row. But tell us about the Above the Rim. This is where we get to the Above the Rim history of 1994. Tell us about that project in terms of where, once again, you all really brought it together from the East Coast and West Coast, and how Pac became a part of it.
Basically, when Shug got Pac out of jail, that was it. Everything switched over to Tupac. So, you know, but honestly, we didn't do nothing. Okay, so I work with Dre. Look at how many songs Dre did on that soundtrack. Like, we did SWV, we remixed that, and I think one other song. That album had Endo Smoke and few other songs on it. I think it had something from Tupac. I can't remember the song on it, but we didn't do that. The only song I worked on was Pac is California Love, and I don't think Drake did too many more than that. You know, we really didn't do that. We was, he was Death Row, so he was making money regardless of who produced it. That's why people be laughing and talking, but it's like, bruh, if you don't got to be the producer and you make more money because it's your record label, Tupac trying to Dre. Everybody don't seem to understand that. They see it another way. Like, Tupac and Dre, he was mad at Dre. They throw Suge in there. They don't realize that Dre was the boss. Suge wasn't the boss. Suge worked with Dre.
Uh-huh.
And then he became, you know, he just began to exercise more of his own force until Dre was uncomfortable and started another company. And that's it. Like, so as far as that, I'm going to tell you this, too. When we did Above the Rim, I worked on two songs. I left and went to Texas with CJ Mack. I was out there with Jay Prince and all them. And then Above the Rim dropped while I was in Texas. I'll tell you this. I heard the impact of my music in another city firsthand. Every car
right.
that went by was driving, was playing a different song on the soundtrack. And I knew all of it. I was like, even Lord G, I'm like, man, what is going on here? This thing is big. And sure enough, it's about 3 million of them. Bang, real quick. You can tell the story.
Doug, look,
that's what I like.
Look, Chris, Doug told us a story about when we had him on the show. And when we talked to Doug off air, he told us about when they went to Freakman in Atlanta in 1994. And he was like, that's all everybody was playing.
Man, you know what? That's real, too. Because we, in 92, we had went through Atlanta and all of them when the Chronic first dropped. By
right.
the time 94, it was Snoop and that. It was both of them albums. And Above the Rim. It was like, because all of that, so we dropped Dre. Then we drop Smooth, then we drop Above the Rim. Oh. Hello.
I'm
good. No fail. Mini. I think that
so we
back, is what? Hang on one second.
So we backtrack
yeah,
and we
got
to take it to, like, the most anticipated album.
You got Rainbow
album
or Biscotti? So, say the question again, I'm sorry.
Yeah, not a problem. Yeah, so we got to, so we got to rewind it to the most anticipated album of 1993 with Snoop Dogg when he gets his solo project, Doggy Style. You know, and we, and once again, we had got the word that there was going to be a Snoop Dogg solo project. No need to talk about all the drama that went on behind it. You know, we don't need to rehash all that history. But what was those sessions like in terms of when you all got the green light to do that album? And just what it was, just the we know that it was, we know what with Dog, what with Doggy Style, that was not the full version in terms of what you all had in mind. Correct me if I'm wrong on it, because I know there was a lot of stuff going on. I know y'all had to get the album out. But what was those sessions like in terms of the vision you had for it and how it came out, and were you all satisfied with the sound of it at the end?
So what, wait, did you say that we had to sacrifice, or we were, so let me tell you what happened. I hear what you say. So this
right,
is how me and Dre work. We finished
yes,
when we're finished. Ain't
got
no
it,
rush. We missed about 50 deadlines. They were trying to pressure us for that. Let me tell you, man, that Snoop album, they was trying to pressure us like a mother for that.
I know.
Jimmy,
why, yeah,
bro.
That we know the story,
and
about
it was like, man, would you
say,
quit calling up here? Would you, what do you, so, you know, me, I'm a Vulcan. I'm Spock, bro. I don't even hear those humans. I walk right beyond them. I keep it pushing, bro. Jimmy Iovine, that's a bird to me. He wasn't paying my check. I was walking to Dre. When he said, hey,
gotcha,
love, I said, how you do, Jimmy? Keep it stepping. I don't know these dudes. So there's a point where, now, I did a lot of things on this record. You know, and see, a lot of this, I'm very tall, right? I'm 6'6". So, like,
yes, sir.
You know, Suge didn't approach, he didn't, now, I was a very smart guy. I'm still smart,
mm-hmm,
I believe. And I was smart enough not to fuck with you. But he didn't
right,
give me the
right,
same, I wasn't terror-induced like everyone else. Like, he was a badass, and I was had the appropriate amount of fear but and respect, but it wasn't like, so when they would challenge me, I'm a pushback guy if it's not right.
Like, I'm trying to make the best shit here. Y'all dudes trying to get make a buck. We trying to make history,
right.
So beat it, right? We'll be finished when we're finished. So there was
a point where we
have finally got all the songs mixed, and I'm editing the album together. We had sequenced it, which takes another 2 weeks, and finally got the shit off the whiteboard, and it's looking good. We got it in order. We done listened to it. I got this half-inch tape, which is the only master. I got a razor blade in my hand trying to edit the parts together. I got Jimmy Iovine on the left, Suge Knight on the right over my shoulder, like, hey, Glove, can you think you could hurt, you know, go faster, blah, blah, blah. Jimmy's like, yeah, you know, we got plane waiting $15,000 an hour, just sitting on the tarmac waiting to fly it to five trucks. You got trucking companies. I looked at him. I had Remy the razor blade, and I told Suge, you can sit down and do this shit yourself. And I got up. No, it's okay, Glove. And they left. They left.
And
Suge will tell you, don't fuck with Glove, bro. Don't do that.
And
he's going to make it take longer.
And see, that's why we wanted to get the story from somebody who was there, because we heard the stories even back then about what was going on. So it's great to hear from somebody who actually was instrumental in it and what was going on in it in terms of those deadlines.
We don't believe in deadlines. We make music, bro. We don't do TV shows.
And at the core of it, Chris, you all are artists in terms of this is your baby and how you want it to be. So you want to put the best project out that you know there's going to be, that you all, number one, are satisfied with, and then how the public will receive it. When you look at music today from how you all did it, how do you feel about a lot of the artists coming in? Because there was a process. You know, we all came up in that era where you really, really had to have something in order to get in. And now you see a lot of artists who really, I'm going to just be real, they treat it as a hobby, not as a passion, not as their life story. And they just, nowadays with some of the music we hear, it's not really imaginative. It's very cut and dry in terms of copy and paste, follow what the next man or woman is doing, and how I can just get something out on social media to get everybody following my eyes. You all didn't do that back then. How do you feel, where do you feel the art as today is in terms of the culture and what we're seeing now?
Hey, man, let me tell you, when I was coming up,
there
was a whole lot of stuff music that nobody liked, you know, so a whole lot of hip-hop that you never heard that was bad. So, personally, I feel like music is where it should be. And I'm at a, so at my age, I'm not trying to hear what the newest bop is at when I was 13. Even though I'm a DJ still, I don't need that. But when I do hear the newest bop, I can tell you if it's hot or not. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
right.
I don't care what the music sounds like, bro. I make music, bro. I don't give a fuck about music or what it sounds like. I can make it be any way I want. I only listen to my music, bro. Let me put you like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't listen to records. I was a DJ so heavy. All I did was listen to other people's records. I'm just even in the score. I'm listening to my music. Mm-hmm. Period. I make records. I make tracks. It's a rare occasion that I listen to something newer. Like the other night, my sister was playing. I had posted something with Kenny G where he wanted to battle Andre 3000, and my sister didn't. So she downloaded Andre 3000's album so we could hear it, and I listened to a few minutes of it. That's like the most recent, and then I like that song Float by Janelle Monáe. You see what I mean? Like,
right.
So that's your answer, how I feel about it, I guess. But I've always been like that, except for the things that I mentioned, like, what, Off the Wall, All in All, or anything Earth, Wind & Fire, anything Ronnie Laws, anything Parliament. They don't have those groups no more. It ain't nothing to compare.
Yeah.
So what they get off on is something else. I'm not into that. So my daughter gets turned up when Kalen For Real shows up. I think I sing better than him. There you go. I was in an R&B group in the 90s. We went on tour. I could show pictures and albums. Kalen For Real is hot. Auto-tune does a lot. I'm messing with it myself. Hey, look, I'm not against any of that. I love it. I listen to see what my daughter's 18, so I see what she listens to, and I like the fact that she knows all the words to the 90s songs that I play. I was listening to Silk the other day, and she was over here going, "Freak Me, Baby." You know, she knew the words. Yeah. She was like, they was nasty back then. I said, that dude is saying he want to F you. What you talking about? At least homeboy said, let me lick you up and down. He didn't say, let me F you up and down.
But, yeah, he went the PG route with it.
Exactly.
But even back in the days of Barry White and all of them, you know, when they strung the slow jams, and you know, Teddy Pendergrass, you know, it was never explicit. And even in the 90s, even in the 80s going into the 90s, you know, it was always the innuendo. Like when you had the whispers, you know, and we begin to rock.
Exactly.
Steady
rocking
all night long.
Yeah, that's hot.
Yeah, I mean, in the era we all came up in, and this is not us being the old men screaming off the hill, but the era, King's 40, I'm 45. So the era of music we grew up in between really being born in 78 and 83, respectively, we were within a 20-year period of listening to the Beatles, James Brown, you know, Jefferson Airplane, Earth, Wind & Fire.
Y'all heard everything. Y'all came at the right time, right?
Yes.
In the 80s was new.
Yes, Madonna.
Sheep was new. And Leon Silver III.
Yeah. You know, Atlantic Star, SOS Band.
Right.
You know.
There you go.
So it curated mature and hone our musical ears. When we started seeing sampling become real heavy in rap songs, we knew where those samples were coming from because we'd already been familiar with it. And it really gave us an appreciation for the foundation of what was laid for a lot of those artists that will come along the way later on. You know, when we look at hip-hop from 1984, in terms of really when it started to become big, you know, with Def Jam, you know, you start seeing LL, you know, the Fat Boys, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, KRS, Ice-T, N.W.A. We start seeing from 1984 on up. This is when it really becomes a thing. You know, so we're seeing how a lot of those influences, those musical influences would influence the artist and how it was really kind of laid that groundwork for the classic stuff Gray, everybody, you know, would, you know, ultimately do. Like you said, Bobcat, you know, to see guys like Zink, Battlecat, everybody.
Yep.
And I guess we reminisce on it because we don't necessarily see a lot of times some of the newer artists coming in giving that same level of reverence and respect to those that came before. Social media has given the cheat code in a sense, and it's not that we hate social media. We love it because we're looking for Off the Cuff Radio, what we've been blessed with. But it's, in terms of the musical aspect, a lot of these artists coming in, they begin to think because they get a popular bop on the radio that they can see the process like, okay, I'm popular, but I don't have to be good at it. I don't have to pay homage to the legends. And I'm like, no, because what they have are material that's classic that it will last beyond after they're gone. I'm like, y'all motherfuckers might be forgotten next week. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but you know, people are as people are. I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe they don't know. Maybe they weren't taught. Maybe it's not Maybe they're not dissing us because they don't know. They just, nobody told them. And then here we come telling them, man, you don't know, and we coming off all wrong and shit. So nobody want to hear that.
Right.
They rather hear,
hey,
listen to this. And it's like, man, that's the shotgun. That's hot. Who did that? Oh, this is a group that I listened to when I was 17. That's better. That's how our parents did it. They would talk crazy about our music and then play something hot. What you gonna do when the? Have you heard the number one song when I was born was "You Beat Me to the Punch"? You guys know the number one song. Look up the number one song when you was born, so you know what the world would think about. So,
got you.
I listen to "You Beat Me to the Punch." They got that little beat, bro. That's "You Beat Me to the Punch." Man, bro, I could see everybody dancing to that in my mind. Like, this is hot. Like, do that. That's the beat. It's the beat. They didn't mix it like we do and make it loud, but they could feel it and catch the swing. You know? And so now we came with big beats and big drums. Now the next group is coming with weird sci-fi sound. That's their shit. I'm going to have it. Don't be mad.
Yeah.
Go make music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, they don't pay homage, start a museum. Teach them. Don't be mad. Teach them.
Yeah, the lane is too big. That's like, I can't really get that, like, you know, because I don't really listen to a lot of mainstream. Now, if you really cover the layers of hip-hop, hip-hop is still moving greatly. Like, you got the youngsters doing it, you know, lyricism, they bring in a little check of lyricism. You have the veterans still doing it. The veterans are still touring and making a killing ton of money. Hip-hop is going fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're complaining like a motherfucker.
Let the young people have their music, man.
Well, I don't do Molly and I don't get turned up, but I know a high beat when I hear it. I don't care what tempo it is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I know Drake is dope. I know that.
You know, people try to hate on Drake, and it's because he's an easy target. You know, Drake is just a regular dude who just, he's not a gangster rapper, but Drake found his own lane. And, you know, people try to take shots at him, but I'm like, that dude, in terms of how he really, because I tell people, I knew about Drake going back to the MySpace days back in 2006. This is like when he's just trying to, like, really, you know, figure out how he's going to do it. You know, you're seeing it, the nascent beginning, but it wasn't bad, his early stuff, but it was like, you know, it's like anybody, you're still kind of honing, you're trying to figure out where it is. And then 2009,
man, when I heard Drake, when he first came out with that "Girl, You My Everything," whenever year that was, he was fully formed, dude.
Yeah,
he came out fully formed.
Yeah,
and he just went up the ladder.
Yeah, and I mean, this is a guy.
It was almost like he was built. That's that shit I was telling you. 13 million, bro. So 13 million at this light skin dude. See what happens. Oh,
man,
boy, the girls love him.
Man, the blog era rappers was good, man. Like, even when you had Kendrick Lamar set the new bar, you had J. Cole coming in, you had Mac Miller, Wiz Khalifa, Big Crit, Drake included. I'll probably throw Meek Mill out there.
Hey, none of them dudes you named are special, man. My daughter go crazy when Drake come on. That's all I know. Like, I hear all them dudes, but I produce Snoop. He came out number one, and ain't nobody ever sold more than him in a day.
Right.
I'm that brain. Like, what? No. Something ain't right. Oh, there you go. Thank you, Mommy. Sorry, y'all.
You good.
Yeah, man, get my little lab opened up for me. So, yeah, man, I'm telling you. All that, Meek Mill, cool. Such and such, cool. Drake got a jet.
Yeah.
And it's a 767, bro. It ain't no G nothing. You can put 3 G5s in it. Ain't nobody talking nothing about that. That boy hot, man. Leave that dude. And talk mess about him. You're going to get served. That dude got lyrics. I see him kill careers. What's the name is Dunn? Pusha T, over. He can't put no record out. Let him try. Drake got a camp of people that'll buy his record and burn it. Like, you'll never be heard. We'll buy them all. Leave them all like nuts, bro. They got fans, Barbs and Swifties and shit, bro. We didn't have that. Like, they got nicknames. What's Beyonce's girls called? They got names, man. They,
the Beehive.
They got fan base. Yeah, there you go.
Man.
They got Beehives and Swifties and fan bases.
Hey, you know, to be off record for a bit, honestly, I did a post about Beyonce earlier. I might take that shit down. I don't want the Beehive coming
out. You better be careful. They will bug your ass. They coming. Watch. And
man,
then the
look,
Swifties is worse.
Look, fam. Look, remember, because remember some years ago when Carrie Hilson kind of tried to come at Beyonce and that Beehive stung her behind that?
Carrie Hilson had a record out since.
Man.
Yeah,
you
got to look at what really happens. Like, they killed her career, bro. She done. Carrie Hilson was fine, too.
But,
was a motherfucker.
But, Chris, it was crazy because when I first heard the track, my first thought was, why would Carrie even open up the door for something like that to happen? I'm like, because that
was what
like
happened.
Random.
Did she copy her or something?
I think,
I don't
honestly.
I don't know the about that.
I think it was just a situation. I think Carrie may have felt, and I don't want to go on record on the show saying I know exactly, but I think it was just a situation Carrie felt a certain way about Beyonce. I'm not gonna pretend like I know the reason why, but when the song dropped, obviously what she sang in it, it was a lot of people took as a direct shot at B. And B never said nothing to her. As far as we knew at the time, Beyonce never had no problem with Carrie. So we're looking at Carrie come at her and we're like, we're just looking like, what we do, like, war? Like,
she made herself look bad, huh? She made herself look bad with that bullshit.
And I mean, you got to think about it. I mean, this is like going back like, what, 10, 12 years ago?
Yeah, Beyonce fans, and I'm saying, you got to mess with them Eminem fans too. Yo, they will say, look, Machine Gun Kelly, he ain't the same stuff. Amen.
He was like, I'm tapping out. I'm not
look,
messing with y'all.
I'm
going to take my post down.
There are three fan bases that we know that you do not ever mess with. One of them is Beyonce, the other is Eminem, and the other is Tupac. Leave those fan bases alone.
Hey, you better not say nothing about Tupac, bro. You might get somebody at your house.
We know.
You
look,
can't be doing that
people,
stuff.
We know people that knew Tupac personally, in terms of like family members. We've had the privilege to meet them, so we understand what pop means to them. And I'm like, that's family. I'm like, and you got people who never met him that will ride for him.
The public.
Man,
that's worse than family, nigga. They think they own
it.
The public. That's my Tupac. I can hear it now. Each one of them individually, that's there too. That's like Jesus. Everybody think it's one God. No, it's 7 billion people on earth. It's 7 billion versions of Jesus, because your Jesus and my Jesus is different.
And they'll tell you that.
It can't help but be different.
Tupac transition to the level of James Cagney and Gandhi.
Yeah, he about that Martin Luther King status now, bro. This motherfucker way past James Dean. I mean, way past James Dean, nigga. Like, Tupac is God to some people. It's so crazy. Like, I met him. He's not God, but I'm not going to argue with you. You go ahead. So crazy.
Because, yo, any when I look at some of the people that do interviews, most notably, you know, one of the biggest YouTube channels out right now, and I see anything saying anything unfavorable to Pac, I'm like, yo, them Pac fans gonna tear that nigga up, man.
Hey,
you might have to limit your comments. You about to limit your comments now.
Yeah, turn them off quick. Too late. They started comments on his ass like, bam. I'm telling you, man, you got to be careful with these artists. People love them, and they will kill you. Seriously.
What does
like, they give you, like, social media crucifixion. Go ahead.
Yeah.
If I was an artist.
Yeah, you're an artist. You as an artist, as a producer, as a legend. What does it mean for you when your music, your art connects with the audience in such a way that they are that impacted, that they really feel you being a part of who they are as a person, how you help them navigate their life, and how you help them find their way?
Wow. I'll tell you, the one thing I love is hearing people tell me that they started a thing because of me. Like Eminem told me he started rapping because he heard Reckless. And I was like, whoa, you sold more records than anybody on earth, brother. Like, okay, I had something to do with you becoming an artist. I'll take that. You know, shit, Ice-T had it in his movie. He was like, hey, Ice knew what to do with it. He ran with it. Like, hey, let me put this, can I get you in the movie, M? Will you say that in my movie? Like, I wonder how much that costs. But, yeah, you know, them cats, they get shit done. But anyway, yeah, I like to be, I love hearing that I impacted someone with my music. It's just a chuckle to me because, like, I never considered, you know, when I made music, I made it. I never threw it away or nothing. But imagine if I just said, I don't like these songs, and just deleted them and went on about my life and became a doctor or some shit. Like, people wouldn't even be saying, hey, as a doctor, you influenced me in Brazil. Like, as a street dancer, I got off the street and got off heroin. And what? Like, it's some crazy stories out here, bro. All beautiful. Like, man, I'm just so happy to have been influential in any form in another human's life, bro, that's positive, without opening my mouth. Like, that's to be reserved to your family and, you know, your parents and your teachers. But people tell me all the time, if it wasn't for you, I'm like, damn, for real? What about that class counselor that kept your ass out of fucking jail? What about him? I'll think something like that, too. I'm not being rude, but I just be thinking to myself, when people tell me how much I changed their life, I'll be like thinking, I wonder what the camp counselor did for them. You know what I mean? Like, on my mind, because that person must have helped them, too. Like, they must got a story for their third-grade English teacher. You know what I mean? Like, I love it. So I just want to always be influential in the thought process of a human. If I can help them think better in any way, help their life, that's it. I'm super happy with that. I would like to make money, too, but... You know, God feeds you regardless. I found that out again today. Like, you eat. God will feed you, period.
Now,
you should run a test if you don't believe me.
Also, now, Chris, you also, and I mean, that's so beautifully put in terms of you as an artist and as a human being so in touch with the pulse of humanity in terms of really, you know, being appreciative of it, you know, where sometimes we don't always think that some artists are able to fully acknowledge. Like, everybody got upset with Doja Cat, you know, about what she said about she didn't necessarily love all of her fans or feel connected, not because she hated them, but it's like because she's like a lot of them she didn't know. And when she said it, I got what she was saying, because she's like a lot of those
but
people.
But you
she's
can't
never met.
Say that.
Right. But I was like,
you gotta be careful with your fans.
Yeah. Because when you say things like that,
they feel slighted because they support you.
Right, exactly.
And when you don't support them, it's not about nothing but that support. They support you. They buy your records. They listen to your junk. They go defend you against other people. And then you're going to say this? Like, that's wrong, bro. Like, I told my friend today, I said, I'm building a community with my group, with what I'm doing musically, with my little package as an artist. I'm going to build a community. My whole thing is based on the same NFT concept of growth in community. Everybody makes money, whole shit, making shit valuable, make it to where it's profitable for all. It's like low-key communism, but not, you know. But anyway, you know, you just have to I don't know. I feel like people, when it comes to creativity, you know, be careful with what you say about the people who support your creative efforts, you know?
Right.
Like,
right.
Because then they won't, and then you have nothing, and then you'll be like, what did I do? Oh, woe is me, and with the bullshit, when you screwed up. Like, don't be mean to people. Don't say, I don't love you. You don't have to tell them. They know you don't love them. They just wish you would like them a lot or something. Like,
and they,
you know,
and they
like
just
want to
feel
stuff.
Acknowledged. They just want to feel acknowledged.
Yeah. That's why, I do this thing when I'm on my live where I do a roll call and I say everybody's name that's on my live that I can read their name, because I know I like to hear my name when I go on somebody's live. You feel me?
Right.
And that's really the only reason I do it, bro. Like, I do. It might sound hella benevolent or I'm a nice guy, but nah. I like hearing my name, so I'm going to say other people's names. Why the fuck not?
And
then guess,
you know,
what?
One thing of,
I hear my name every time I tap into a lot. It works. Trust me.
But that's the one thing about it, I think, you know, King and Chris, that people got to understand, support costs nothing. To be positive is priceless. And, you know, to put something out there of optimism in a world where things are not always, you know,
optimistic.
You know, it means a lot. We see enough negative shit. We see niggas goddamn fighting like motherfuckers online, talking shit, talk about fade, that they never gonna run, and them niggas can't even run a marathon talking about they're gonna run a fade with somebody. You know, I'm like,
they can't even run at all.
They might run away. They might run away, but they're not going to
run.
They
can't even do that because they're going to fall down. You ever see them dudes that get in fights that throw one blow and they tired? They winded. You can't run. They too tired. They talking, bro. They mouth make them. Man, hang on. I'm talking so much shit. Let me rest. You know what I'm saying? It's like that. So go ahead, continue. I agree with you is what I'm saying.
No, you good. Yeah, I mean, it's dope. I mean, yeah, we want to hear your response to that. Now, you came at a time, you all as a collective came at a time where gangster rap was really becoming a thing and becoming more and more criticized. You know, Calvin Butts, C. Dolores Tucker, you know, the PMRC, all these people who were trying to say
Tipper
that.
Gore.
Tipper Gore, I mean, she, yeah, with the Prince album in 1984, that's where the whole sticker thing came. People looked at gangster rap as a cause of what was going on, but didn't understand it was the effect, and it was the recollections. It was the dissertation.
It was the result.
It was exactly. It was the result of what
it
was going
on. It wasn't the start. It was the result of the bullshit they was doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I wish more people back then understood that.
And
but
me and
also
Special Ed
element.
Had a real good talk about that.
Shout out to Special Ed because we had him on the show last year. And, of course, when he was on Drink Champs, shout out to EFN, Nori, you know, Mr. Lee Sanchez. You know, we had Lee on the show some months ago. Great host, great guest. We love him dearly.
Yeah.
There was a lot of controversy with what Ed said. And King and me, we understood it to a degree.
But us West Coast guys,
go ahead,
we're not going
please.
For that
go ahead,
because there was people getting murdered and people dying and niggas, y'all don't know what PSK is? Peachtree Killers, like
killers.
PSK was Parkside Killers, mother. They act like nigga Special Ed, go do your own homework, motherfucker. Get out of here with that shit. Niggas is mad because we outsell them by millions, like a lot of millions, bro. Like I said, bro, they get so mad they created West Coast. We can't call it L.A. music, man. They too big, man. We can't fucking call it that. It ain't no borough. Compton is bigger than all of – Compton sold more records than probably New York State. Literally, a lot of the best rappers come from Jersey and Long Island. So you got Nas. They lucky they got Nas. Nas didn't go to his grandma's house or something and start rapping from there because – But, I mean, I love New York, okay, and I love the East Coast, and I was part of that East Coast-West Coast shit before. It started with Ice-T and LL Cool J. It didn't start with Big and Puffy. We was already at the boiling point then, like, fuck y'all, fuck y'all, fuck you, fuck you. You've been saying fuck you, fuck you.
So you can give us some history behind this, Chris, because
what really started that thing between Ice-T and LL? How did that really become? I like to think I know my history, but that's one thing. I never knew how that started between them.
It started over a chick.
Don't we talk about
all
this off air?
It never fails.
Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper. He was hot, too. I see, you know, he going to get chicks, man. He got that hair, and he pretty, man. That's Ice. He a pimp, too. He know how to talk to him. Man, don't go up against that. When it's chicks involved, you better lay back and let Ice talk, nigga. You trip. He going to get all of us some pussy. Cut it out. And Jack the Ripper. He was pissed about some chick shit, man. And he was younger than us anyway. But LL's a homie, though. I produced him, too.
Yeah. Shout out to Ice-T. He's always supported off the cover.
That's my dude right
shout
there.
Yeah,
I
man,
got his
solid.
Back. That's my dude.
Ice
solid
guy.
Yes, he is. The shout out to Douglas.
Gotcha. And Darlene Boo.
Yeah. Shout out to Ms. Ortiz, the OG herself.
Yeah.
Shout out
and
to
Coco.
Little Ice.
She
shout
cool.
To yeah,
all
man.
All of them. He got cool people. Even his ex is cool. Like,
look.
Got them all getting along.
Wonderful man, bro.
Look, hey, you got them all getting along.
How you think you do, Sister Wise?
Chris,
how else
you going to
do, Sister Wise?
Yeah, we got to shout out, of course, his biographer, Douglas Century. We've had him on the show a couple of times, New York Times bestselling author, and, of course, you know, Spike. You know, we got to shout out all of the crew, man. You know, they've all supported us. We love them dearly. When you look at what was going on at that time, because you were an active participant in terms of the music and the art, and you still were on the front lines of seeing a lot of this stuff erupt, what did it mean back in the day when you actually had problems with somebody? Because we knew about a lot of stuff. You know, of course, A and Quit back in the day. Of course, they're best friends now. You know, Cube and Dre eventually settled their differences.
Well, ours was
you know,
easy, remember?
Right.
It was easy. So with us, it was easy. It wasn't too many of that going on in L.A. It was cliques and all that, but they didn't trip on each other. It wasn't too much of that. It was like money.
Right.
Like if somebody stole from somebody, then they're going to get fucked up. Like Jerry Heller got Ice Cube pissed and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, you know, Jerry got Dre pissed. It was all, that whole breakup of that was from Jerry. So, Jerry was a brilliant man and he knew where the hell he was doing. I tell you this, Jerry was always down for his client and that was easy eat. He didn't steal from him. And I learned a lot from Jerry. Now, I didn't like all his practices and or all the things that came out of his mouth, but who do you like everything they say? Nobody. You and your best friend argue. You guys on the phone argue about something he said or she or you said. So, you know, probably not often, but it has happened. Humans have disagreements. But, you know, we just got to remember to be respectful, and also we don't know what we don't know. So if you think about what you don't know, you can shut the fuck up. Like, man, I don't even know if this dude just climbed out of a burning fucking volcanic fire to save his children just to get over here to get in line in front of me at El Pollo Loco. You know what I'm saying? I'm telling him, fuck you. And he just, man, that motherfucker might rip your head off. Like, just because.
You're right. You are right. You are, nigga, you are absolutely right. And,
you feeling me? Like, just keep it cool.
And what we're seeing now, Chris, because you all come from a you're born and raised in L.A., so you understood it from a music level, you understood it from a street level, especially with the banger. So you knew when the shit got real on the turf, you knew you saw shit.
How to exit stage left, motherfucker. Let me tell you what I do. I'm gonna tell you something. Have you ever? Okay, so I told you I was 6'6", right? Have you ever noticed? Whenever you see the movies and shows in Africa, you don't see the giraffes running from nobody. You see, like, the buffalo running from the lions and the rhino or whoever. You see these. But the giraffes, let me tell you what giraffes do. They see that shit. Oh, here come the lions. They're, like, 18 miles away. Let's start walking. Giraffes are always walking. That's me, bro. I see the shit coming. I'll turn and walk out of there. I don't know nothing. These niggas are killers. I'm over here. Goodbye. Like, I'm a giraffe, bro. I was in the studio when Chill got arrested for doing, whatever it was that he did 10 years, I was in the room when that shit happened. And it's like a giraffe. I said, these niggas said, what? I heard it. Man, let me tell you what happened real quick. So, Suge, we had just got $1 million with a publishing deal, Dre and Dot. And so they was complaining to Suge, like, man, people keep using the phone. So everybody always think it's Suge. Suge is an enforcer. Suge is a gun. Somebody else pulls the trigger, always with Suge. Right now he in jail, so he pulling his own trigger. But normally somebody got to get him pissed off to do shit. He don't just do it. You know, he ain't crazy crazy. He just borderline crazy. He like pit bull crazy. Like he'll bite you and go, oh shit, you my owner. Fuck, I fucked up. Now I got to get put down. But I'm going to bite you again then. Fuck it. You know what I mean? That's Suge. So when shit go, when them dudes came in the studio, we had just found out that it was a it was like an $80,000 phone bill from Snoop being in jail and calling Collect and a bunch of other people, but it was like $80,000. So that's when we really got heavy with Harry-O, and, you know, he had to run up some money, so he gave us $300,000, and that's how he invested in Death Row. He wasn't at the beginning and all that. I mean, he was. All this happened before we had a name. So so remember I told you this phone bill, right? So these niggas was on the, this nigga was on the phone. Suge walked in, the dude was on the phone, and Suge said, hey, man, you know, hope that's not long distance. We just had a high phone bill. We're trying to keep the phone down. And this nigga said, Dre told me I could use this phone. And Dre looked at that nigga. I was between them. And Dre looked over. I'm looking at Dre. Dre was like, nigga. Dre turned. I saw Dre go to what I call silent mode. He was like, okay then, nigga. You going to say that? I am not responsible for what happens next. He turned his back. Suge said, what did you say? He said, Dre said I could use it. And he had a little bit of snap to him, like he, you know, he thought he was whatever. And we just record guys. So he's like, Dre said I could do this. Like, I did not hear this. I'm embellishing myself, Suge, and anyone else is listening. But basically it sounded to me like, Dre said I could use this phone, nigga, and I don't give a fuck. That's what I heard in my mind, because I got up out of my seat, and I walked past Suge into the hallway, right? And Suge said, hey, partner, get off the phone. Whenever partner come out his mouth.
That's a warning right there.
Bro, that was the first blow. The next one is going to be physical or hot lead.
Right.
So I heard partner from the hallway, and then I heard, boom, boom, get the nigga. And I heard they got handcuffed together, stripped naked. Whatever he went to prison for is on the record is what I'm going to attest to. Anything other than that,
understood.
I have no knowledge.
Understood.
But
look, but
shit
we,
went down.
But Chris, we heard that story. We just didn't know. We heard the story. We just didn't know the whole context of the story in terms of what happened with that phone call. Because we knew that phone, as far as we knew, the story was about that phone was reserved for Harry-O to call Suge, and nobody was supposed to be on it except Suge.
Yeah, no, that ain't it. The nigga was on the phone. He should have been on the phone.
Got
he got
you.
Smart.
Right. Gotcha.
Harry-O did call it. Man, that phone had fucking 9 lines on it, bro. What the fuck? We had one phone number? Come on, it's Death Row.
Got
don't ever believe
right,
bullshit.
Right.
We had plenty of phone lines. But Suge was like, fuck you. Probably was beating him and said, and that's Harry-O's hotline. Snoop, I used to answer the phone with Snoop right there all the time. I would talk to Snoop. I talked to Snoop probably 30 times from jail. He would call, I asked him, what's up, though? Man, what y'all doing? You meet me? And then I put the speaker on so you can hear the music.
Man.
Y'all working on? We working on this. Yeah, but that story, yeah, that's really what happened, what you heard. That's the truth. With an F, truth,
look,
T-R-U-F.
Look, we thank you for giving clarity on that, Chris, in terms of really, because a lot of people, including us, we didn't know, like, we knew part of it, but we didn't know all of it. So we thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's that perspective, but yes, you're welcome.
Yeah.
There's more. Trust me.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to have you back for part two to tell more of it.
Oh.
When you look at what's going on today in terms of how a lot of these artists are inviting a lot of the trouble and, unfortunately, the death that comes with that trouble, what do you have to tell some of these artists out here in terms of when you start talking shit and acting like niggas ain't going to react on that shit and mock
you? Wow,
we're not talking about
me about it.
Right. Go ahead, please. Cook with
I you. Recommend to everybody out here, man, be respectful, man, to your human being that's out there. Hold on real quick. My headphones on switch.
It's okay.
Hey, Pete, I'm on an interview still, but I'm about to get on that stuff. I just got to the tilt. I'm going to call you back when I finish this. I'm on the radio. Pete Farmer, my manager. I'm going to announce him on the station. All right, John. He did
Bars. Thank you. Shout out to Pete.
Yep. Shout out to Pete Farmer. Yeah, man. He was working with Babyface in L.A. back in the day all the way up to now. He's a great dude. So,
okay.
Yeah, man. Don't be disrespectful, man. Like, I was working on some shit today, and I know it's just because I'm doing this song with this guy. He said something about G-Unit. I just take that shit off, man. You don't even know G-Unit.
Right.
Just because
right.
you're doing a song with somebody that's affiliated with somebody who don't like them, you don't jump into the fray. Leave that shit alone.
Right.
But I always recommend to not, because I've been on a lot of battles. Look, man, we got no Vaseline. I've seen cats get their ass beat over playing that record. I ain't seen Ice Cube get beat up. I ain't seen Dre get beat up. I've seen a gang of DJs get their shit broke and hit in the face over that record.
Damn.
So, yeah, more than five. So, yeah.
But you know, Chris, Uncle Ice has always given the gems of wisdom. And what he said, yeah, I saw it in the interview, and I never forgot this, what he said. And he said, usually it's the niggas, even if they don't like each other, it's usually not the niggas who dislike each other going to blows. It's the niggas with
them. It's the niggas that's with them.
Exactly. And
yeah, because they don't like none of it, and they don't like them. And half the time, they don't like the damn nigga they with because he's flossing and got money. Man, look, everybody that was with IC did not love IC, okay? Let me tell you another thing. Everybody that buys your ticket to your concert is not going there to – listen, people buy tomatoes and tickets, okay?
And they can – so they can throw the tomatoes at you.
You're motherfucking right. They come prepared with shit to throw at you, okay? They come ready to throw shit at you. Like, how can I fucking
ooh,
sell it anymore?
Game right there.
There
ooh,
you
say
go.
That again.
You got
say
it.
That again.
They come
say that
prepared.
Again.
They'll buy your ticket and a tomato to come and throw it at your ass. Do not think everybody that buys your record or your music or your tickets is a fan. A lot of them are detractors. They want to see what you got. You know you sound good, so they studying you. Everybody got your shit don't like you. Everybody don't like you. I like you guys. I like you, too. Both.
We
just
appreciate
met. Y'all
it. Thank
cool.
you.
But, I mean,
thank you.
I don't like everybody, though. You know what I'm saying? And everybody don't like me.
Right.
But I'm telling y'all that. Then I like to be out so they know. Well, Gloves said he liked me, so I believe it. You know what I mean? They ain't going to be, I'm gone, and niggas like, man, Gloves didn't like you. Fuck you. He told me he liked you. You can say that. You know? You know what I'm saying? And that's what people, that's why you tell your people that you love them when you can, because they can say, fuck you, he said he loved me. I don't give a damn. Because that's where you're going to get the hate. Somebody die and they know somebody you know and they're going to come into bullshit to make you feel worse.
Ooh.
It's not, it's natural, bro. They just do it. It just happens. But it happens and you don't want that shit. So eat a dick. Like, you know what I mean?
But that's real shit, Chris, because this is one thing about we always, and we've learned this being blessed to do what we do. Like Benny has on his new album, the title Everybody Can't Go. Shout out to Benny the Butcher and Griselle,
right.
Black Soprano Records, all the whole crew, Tony De Niro, Street Soprano. Yes,
ooh.
We're famously shouting out our people. You know, those are our guys.
But everybody can't go.
Yeah, and also, too, you have to be careful about who you bring in your circle, because your circle, you know, is if you're in the atmosphere way up in space in terms of really doing it, you know there's no air in space. What happens? You got people in that circle or the bubble who's going to punch it out and everybody suffocates. You got niggas that'll burn down the whole ship because they can't be captain.
Because they
you
can't
know?
Be in the boat. Fuck captain. They can't even go, so they're going to make the ship not go. They're going to go call the cops. Nobody go. Yeah, that's the haters. I had a guy, funny you tell that story, I had a guy that was an incredible musician. He could play guitar, keyboards, wonderful guy, right, a white guy. So I started working with him. I went to work with Dre right when the pandemic started, right in June of 2020. I go fly out to Dre's house to work on some music with him. And so whenever I work with Dre, first I go spend a couple of weeks at Record One writing music that I'm going to give to him. So he get, you know, he'll book me studio time. I'll go there and do that. So I always put together a team when I'm working, like see who's fucking with me. I'm a vibe dude, right? So I met this guy, very cool. I loved his work, and the people he brought around me are fantastic-ass artists with him. So I was like, cool, I'm fucking with this dude. I worked with him for 2 days, and every night when I would work, Dre would say, what you got? Come up here. He called me at 8 o'clock and told me to come up to the house, you know, so he could hear what I was working on. And he got a whole team of motherfuckers up there working. So we would generally go up there and whatever. So I'm doing tracks, and he is. He would work on his track, get done, and say, what you doing? And I bring my tracks up there, and he would work on them. This dude is a beast. He would work on them, too. So this dude, I bring this guy up here. And so this motherfucker, some kind of way, bro, he poked a hole in the bubble. Only thing is, he the only one who suffocated because I knew how to give my guy space suits inside the bubble, right? So this motherfucker got on Dre's last nerve. He made a suggestion for something, and they changed and went with his deal, and the motherfucker was empowered. He thought he was producing. He started getting up at the board, trying to tell a nigga, oh, Dre, you should do this. Tell him, man, will you shut the fuck up? Man, when a nigga like Dre say that to you in the middle of 20 people, I was like, come on, let's go. that nigga never, ever.
It seemed like it takes a lot to get Dre mad.
Bro, it takes more than a lot to get him at this. This is Dre the billionaire, bro.
Yeah.
You don't even get upset because everybody want to sue him. You ain't heard him slap a bitch in years. He used to be a bitch-slapping-ass motherfucker, okay? Let me put it to you like that. I'm kidding. I'm kidding, Dre. You're my nigga. You're not a bitch-slapper. But anyway, you know, Dre's calm, man. Why are you going to fuck with this nigga? And so this motherfucker, the pissed him off. I'm like, whoa, I heard that shit. I was like, man. But see, this is how I work. I know Dre. That shit is not for everybody in the bubble. It's for the bubble breaker. He gets fucked up. So when he was getting cussed out, my people that was with me was all scared and shit, like, oh, man, like, they was next. Like, he was going to turn and say, and the rest of y'all niggas, too, or some shit, right? But I'm back there snickering. I'm acting like I'm asleep, right? I'm snickering to myself. I'm hearing this nigga get cussed out because I told him to shut the fuck up. I said, man, you need to chill, bro. Don't make no more suggestions to shut up. But he didn't hear me, so I let him get this nigga got. Okay, so back in the day, he would have got beat up. Said that shit, and that was the trigger. Dre would have said, nigga, will you shut the fuck up? And that means when this dude get alone, beat his ass. And they would. They would be like, Dre, we need to do that for you. And he'd be like, cool. Or not. I don't know what he's up. But I know that happened a lot. Like, it wasn't just once. People used to piss him off because they was dumb. Like, people don't know what they don't know, bro. Like, shut the fuck up. You don't know what you don't know. Like, really.
And
you don't know what you don't know. Fuck what you do know.
Yeah. And that's what people got to understand. You know, when you are around certain circles, it's like whether it's a celebrity or a regular person, you have to understand their personality. It's like they're getting to know you just like you're getting to know them. King and me have been blessed to meet a lot of people. You know, I can say on air, Jeezy, Red Cafe, Griselda, you know, well, Black Soprano Family, Benny and all them. I've met those guys. I've hung out with all of them. They know me. I know them. But I always play my position, and I, you know, because it's about how you handle being in that presence. And not everybody knows
you how, said it, you know. So you said you know them. Therefore, you also know how to be around them.
Right.
These people do spend a lot of not knowing. They, like, this guy did not know Dre. He did not know how to be around him. And he kept running his mouth because somebody didn't teach him not to do that when he was a child.
Right.
And he had to learn a hard lesson.
He learned like a motherfucker, dude. My friend, I was like, nigga, tell him again, bro. He be getting on my nerves too now. But we should jump him now. It's like, now I want to beat his ass. You know what I'm saying?
But that's the psychology, though. But that's the psychology, though, because people got to understand that, you know, it is different when you're dealing with people in a certain level of celebrity, because they're dealing with the fact that people want to come to them. People come to them wanting a lot of stuff. Like Biz Markie, the late great legend, said, catching the vapors. You know, and then you got those people.
Oh, yeah.
I will.
They catch the vapors.
I'm not. I'm not going to mention this artist's name, because me and this artist are friends, you know, but I was around him. You know, I was at the show backstage, and then one of his people, you know, trying to start barking at me, and I'm like, and I'm staying calm because I'm like, you know, but I'm like, dude, his bodyguard said I'm okay. His manager, his road manager at the time, slash bodyguard, you know, they all knew me. So it was like, he said I'm good.
And here comes this guy,
dude,
right.
But this dude, but you know, then he had a nigga suit, because I'm 6 feet, he was short of me, so he got that Napoleon complex, but then he wanted to start barking. And I said, you know, it's like, you know, well, yeah, I'm with the crew that here, and I'm like, and I'm just staying calm because I'm like, look, the last thing I want to do is make a bad impression, you know.
For your boy.
But it worked out because I got a kick-ass video of it that night of me and that artist. It's on YouTube. And when I saw that,
man, if he would have got crazy, I'm going to tell you this, though. If you would have got crazy, you should have just pulled a Charleston White and just maced him.
Charleston White is funny as fuck to me. He all gangster and he got maced. Like, where the gun at, nigga? Where the strap, Mr. Fox? He pulling out mace and fucking butterfly juice and shit, nigga. These niggas I ran with, they will shoot your motherfucking ass, nigga. They ain't pulling out mace. Suge don't pull out mace.
I'm like, look,
man.
I'm like, look.
Motherfuckers.
Rolling with them.
Hey, man, motherfuckers is a trip, bro. Y'all know what it is. It's
man,
sure is a trip,
look.
Bro, ain't it?
Dude, mace will take
it's
down the hardest gangsters,
it's real
though,
gangsters
man.
Out here. It's real gangsters out here, too,
that
nigga. Like, they be
burn.
Gangsters. Tell me about it, nigga.
That mace, well, that makes it break Superman down, man. That shit burns.
Oh, yeah, that shit will fuck you up, but that's a security guard move. This nigga got mace, he a security guard. Or he got his girlfriend's mace. Like, I give her pepper spray, you know? I'm not shooting no mace at a nigga. Maybe I
like
should, though, but I'll probably go to jail like the next nigga because I'm shooting his ass.
Man,
I'm
look,
not fucking with nothing. You know,
look,
that's
like
funny because I'm telling y'all that, and I got some mace right here on my table. I'm Charleston White, nigga. I am Charleston White. I got mace. I'm talking all this shit. I don't even have a gun. How about that? I got
man,
mace.
After you hit
so
a certain
Charleston
age,
White,
you like, yeah, after you hit a certain age, you like, you got to change it up a little bit. That's self-defense.
Yeah,
you know, self-defense with mace.
Yeah, you're right. I don't have to go to prison. I could just go to jail. For a few hours, they're going to let me out. It's not assault with a deadly weapon. It's like spray in the face with pepper.
that's a misdemeanor right there versus attempted murder.
Man.
He's amen.
Or
say that
or
again, bro. That's a,
or,
hey, look,
or
that's a I'm
assault.
Going
yes.
home tonight versus I'm not.
Say it again. And see.
Yeah, I'm going home tonight.
And see, a lot of dudes out here got to understand, you know, there's hip-hop and the street are inextricably linked. You know, there's an intrinsic link because
yeah.
hip-hop is street culture. It came from the street. But there's also times, too, when that, like, you know, like Riley, shout out to, you know, Aaron Magruder, the Boondocks, in that episode where, who we were talking about, the nigga moment. And we see a lot of it. And sometimes you got to understand, you know, you don't have to prove anything because niggas who usually are going to try to fuck with you and they know you got something, they will love nothing more than to fuck you up and put them in a position of ain't shit having that they got.
Exactly.
You know?
Right. So
and
you may
you
as well
need,
just turn away and go on.
And you, yeah, you know, it ain't no bitch move. Now, if the nigga bring the,
nope.
the nigga actually touch you with that smoke and he,
man,
and you
look.
Know a threat is real, yeah. then you handle what you got to handle.
Yeah,
but if you can
different.
Get away from it, get away from it
no.
because usually
yeah. And
when
yeah,
niggas
everybody
actually
has to
start
too.
Talking shit, yeah, because when niggas start talking that shit and they really trying to, that usually, I learned on the battlefield.
That's where they're trying to go.
Exactly. And you and they probably got something ready if you move on it. So
that.
You move away
yeah.
from it.
Right.
Don't even,
then,
yeah.
and position yourself accordingly. Right. You got to start, shuffling your feet and get in position so you know you can see everything, ain't nothing at your back, because that's when the niggas creep, hit you over the head. You're like, ah, next thing you know, you shot or back pocket gone or something. With a bruise. That's even just bad. Nigga, you didn't get shot. You got robbed, hit upside the head, and now you less money and mad because you want to kill the niggas, but you kind of off low key scared because they got you.
Now you want to kill these days.
And that's the thing about it, because when you say low key scared, but then that scare turns into anger, and anger makes
murder.
You irrational.
Yeah.
That's where people.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I'm talking about.
You know, and
that's why I said it like that. Exactly.
Yeah, you gotta.
And
you
low key scared, you're gonna do some dumb shit.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I've never forgot that passage in the autobiography of Malcolm X, where he talked about that cop Brisbane, and you know, Brisbane used to shake niggas down, I think in Harlem when Malcolm was out there, but then they said he talked about how Brisbane got killed by this young dude who I guess he shook up a little bit, and the dude killed him, and the dude killed him didn't know, it wasn't around town long enough to know how bad Brisbane was, but Brisbane did something to him. Yeah, because Brisbane shook him up, and the nigga was like, okay, I gotta eliminate this problem.
I'm scared. Yeah, I'm scared.
He
killed the badass cop who was invisible by the newcomer. Nobody even knew. That's exactly what happened. The digger to go, oh, shit, and pull the trigger and kill the bad guy on accident.
And the thing is
And we wanted to ask him questions.
And that's the thing people got to understand. You are a newcomer to a nigga that don't know you. So your reputation don't mean nothing because your information is not established with him. It may be with others, but it ain't with that person. So you always tread lightly because you don't know where that nigga from and he don't know where you from. And depending on the situation, that
Absolutely.
Nigga don't give a fuck where you from.
They sure don't. And then, hey, don't be scared. And him, we both gonna get. You ever see the snakes that killed each other? One choked him and the other one bit him. He died from poison. Mm. They was dead together, wrapped up forever. Mm. Like, they got into a fight. Like, you go kill each other? How about we don't?
What?
Look, we ain't doing no Mexican standoff in this shit.
That ain't right. But, yeah, guys, I think we got to shut it down. Cause, you know, we don't want to get cut off, man. But we thank you for the bill, man.
I'm going to take it to the
line.
I love y'all.
Love you's back, man.
Yeah,
look,
man.
Look, Chris,
yeah.
You're welcome this back anytime. I just hit you on the follow on IG, T-Max and VA.
Oh, perfect.
I'm
going to follow
dude,
y'all, too.
Thank
I was trying
you.
To figure it out.
It's, man, look, Chris, thank you so much for this history. We can't wait for part two because we got so much more we got to talk about, man. Thank you.
Yes,
our
sir.
Best, our love to you and your family. Thank you again so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate y'all for your time. Take care, gentlemen.
You too,
thank
man.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. You too. Take care. Thank you.
West
All right.
Coast.
Two fingers in the middle. Twist it. Let's get it.
Yeah.